It's a documentary in the Oregon Trail video game,
Oh,
which isn't very well known over here, but I know it because I'm a video game nerd, and I'm just interested to see how these guys came up with it back in the day when it was just writing code, and now it's like this big thing that most American kids grow up playing. I'm sure you played the Oregon Trail
Well, it was when they introduced computers into the
in
school
schools.
system.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the game you had. That's the only game that kind of came with the system. So yeah, everybody played it, you
And it was
know.
educational, like
Sure.
pretty educational as well.
And you
Once
all
they
died the
removed
same
all
way,
the
you know.
was it dysentery mostly
Dysentery,
put?
right?
Doctor,
Wait a minute, I hear something. Hey everybody, what's happening? Welcome back to another episode of Dr. Movie, where we're not in a car. We're actually at the house because I got a special guest, also special guest, with me. It is the one and only Dan the Man. His mama is not a snowblower, Dan Bone.
I was going to use that line too.
Oh yeah, of course. What's happening, Dan?
No disassemble, I guess, is the first thing to say, really. No, I'm good. Thank you. And thank you for having me. I'm excited to be on the show again and talking to you and discussing some 80s goodness.
Yeah, it's always a blast, and I mean, if we could find time, I mean, we could have a banger of a show if we just ran with it. But we're both busy people, because I
We
think
are.
it's pretty endless the shows we could talk about. But we are together to talk about Short Circuit from 1986. It's strange when you look at this movie and you put it in perspective of that time frame of how movies were kind of chugging along and the special effects were moving along. This is right in that sweet spot, man, where it was getting to where the special effects were so good, you forgot they were effects. And I said this to Becky a while ago when I was going through it again. I was like, number five is amazing when you look at, even from today's standard of what we think a robot is. It's really impressive.
Yeah, because he looks like a robot, he's not. I mean, obviously it's 1986, there's no CGI. It's they spent a tenth of the budget on just the number five robot alone, and it looks incredible. And certainly as a child, I had no qualms in believing he was just a character. It wasn't until you get a bit older you realize, okay, that's not the case. The same with you recently covered in the Hendersons, and all these kind of movies that were coming out, like you said, chugging along, they made you believe, in the Mogwai, you believed that that was a creature. It's just. And that's the beauty of practical effects, of course, but also the something we passionately believe in, which was that these movies had heart as well. You believed in the story, as silly as it might be, you believed in what was going on.
I saw an interview with the director, and he was talking about if you believe in the character, if you like the main character, you're willing to accept anything that's the story because you've bought into believing in the character. And that's exactly what this is. You know, if you had a, well, it's just like the difference between E.T. and Mac and Me, right?
I'm glad you brought up Mac and me, because
Because there's that thing, right? And even though Mac and Me still has a charm to it, but there's something about really relating. And again, going back to an earlier episode, Harry and the Hendersons, you totally forget that those are effects. You are so buying into, well, wait a minute, I'm watching this thing and I'm feeling affection for this thing. It's not even real. And you got the same thing here, and it's very robotic. And it's again, we keep throwing this around, that 80s magic, because this is a movie that not only adults could go and see, but kids could go and see, and everybody could enjoy this. Is it corny and cheesy? Well, sure, but at the time it wasn't.
So,
This is
Certainly. I mean, you know, rewatching this as an adult, and even as I became a teenager, you realize there are a lot of rude jokes and little things sewn into this for the parents, whilst the kids watching the cute robot. You know, you've got Fisher Stevens saying some quite obscene things here and there, which fly over the kids' heads. You know, you've got all this stuff happening, and there's a lot. And again, it's that sweet spot. I noticed this a lot growing up in the UK. A lot of these movies were on TV, and they were heavily edited because they would just drop, you know, curse words into these PG movies. You don't really get that as much now. And I'm not saying, you know, we need swear words in our movies, but it was just the way that we spoke, you know, and the way that people talked back then as well. And it just made it feel a little bit more grounded. And, you know, if you saw a robot, you're probably going to use a curse word. If you see a robot telling you it's alive, and you know, you're not going to say, oh gosh, darn, what's happening here?
That's a very good point. Hey, here's something. It only got a 6.6 out of 10 on IMDb. I don't think I agree with that.
No. I don't agree with that. You know, I mean, obviously I've got my nostalgia goggles on, and you know, I was 8 years old when this came out. Probably saw it at the age of around 9, maybe, on the rental. I didn't see this one in theatres, but it's incredible. I put this in the same league as Harry and the Hendersons.
Yeah.
You know, all those movies that came out, Inner Space. Ones, just these crazy movies that just happened. And they kind of, a lot of these had sort of science fiction or slightly supernatural elements in them, which added to the weird fantasy world that you were just looking into for 80, 90 minutes. And as a kid, that's all you needed. And, you know, that was, it's that brilliant escape.
And we were getting plummeted with them too, because, you know, Back to the Future, Cocoon, Short Circuit. I mean, this battery's not included. I mean, there was a ton of these coming out.
Yeah.
You can always go back and say maybe E.T. was kind of the start of getting into the interest of technology, futuristic stuff on Earth, which as Star Wars took us, you know, to another galaxy.
Yeah.
That kind of brought it back home and made it relatable in the 80s. This, in case you don't know what this movie is, I'll read a synopsis. When one of the experimental range of military robots is hit by lightning, it's given consciousness. It escapes from the military and befriends a young woman, Stephanie Speck. Its creator, Newton Crosby, is desperate to find it, or his entire project may be scrapped. There you go. Yeah.
Number 5 is alive. What more
number
can you say?
Number 5 is alive.
And it's a great concept, you know, especially back then before we really knew about AI. But back then, artificial intelligence was a robot. Now it's not. It's an actual conscious thing, more or less. So it's a great idea, you know, and it's taken that little bit of Frankenstein, you know, style, the lightning striking something and making it alive, but it's scrambling the circuitry of this robot, this highly advanced $1 million military, you know, and it's very sort of 80s because it's there really to take down the Russians, because this is the 80s American military. That's what they wanted to do back then. And that's all it was, but they're hit by lightning and he starts learning. And again, that's why you fall in love with this guy, because this Johnny Five, because you're watching him almost grow up through this 80-minute movie. He understands what life is. He understands what death is. You know, he understands beauty, and that moment is quite heart wrenching actually, when he realizes what disassemble means and what death means. You know, as a kid especially, you're like, wow, okay.
And what he was created for. He was created to be a disassembler. You know, and I mean, it's an interesting take, and I know I keep bringing up the E.T. thing, because the three stories here, Short Circuit, Harry and the Hendersons, E.T., very much follow the same plot line when you think about it. I mean, there's little things different here and there, but it still comes to somebody that's not used to being around where they are, befriending somebody, learning about society, learning about people, learning about emotions, and then the military tries to come and take them down. I mean, that's pretty much all three movies.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they all have such memorable things that happen in them. Even the TV stuff in this one reminds me of, you know, kind of E.T. does this thing where he's watching the TV and taking stuff in.
Yeah.
And here, I mean, but he's in fast forward, right? Because he's super intelligent.
Oh, yeah. Like when he's reading the books, it's absolutely brilliant. Like, I need more input. And he's thirsty for it. He's like, I need more. And she's like, I've got all the volumes of the encyclopedia on my shelves. Why don't you just read through all of them?
And yeah, that's the
going
thing,
around
too.
The house pointing, going, oh, there's a whisk, and there's an egg, and there's a...
He loves it. Yeah, I mean, it's a brilliant way to show that he's learning. You know, he's learning what everything is. And the fact of... Well, for first thing, encyclopedias. How many of you remember those? Right?
The encyclopedia salesman's at the door. He wants you to buy RS&T today.
now, you know, a robot that this would happen to would just plug into a local computer and just go over the internet and figure things out.
Like
yeah,
Neo
he literally had
Matrix.
To take books and flip the pages faster than humanly possible.
Yeah.
To learn every page and every detail.
You know, and I feel like that was done by Neo in the Matrix, you know, similar concept. And the same with, if you've seen any of the Transformers movies, which I know you have, Bumblebee only communicates through song clips and adverts and commercials. And that's how he initially starts to communicate, you know. So it's definitely influenced. This movie is definitely an influence on future movies and pop culture.
Absolutely. Well, we even get a guitar player named John Five. That's playing with Motley Crue now.
There we go, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's just right there on the nose.
And I strongly believe that this film was remade when they did that movie. What was the movie by, with Chateau Copley, the South African guy, and they've got the robot, and do you know the one I mean? I can't remember the name of it now, for some reason. It's going to really annoy me, but... It feels like that was remade almost because it was a military robot that was rewired by some hoods in the ghettos. And then he started to realize, I don't really want a Chappie. That was it. Yeah. And that feels like almost like a Short Circuit remake.
Sure.
But just a little bit edgier.
Right. Well, that's that thing, right? We have to push it a little further. So when we started this conversation, that's the first thing Dan wanted to talk about is, like I said, with this 80s magic and how we just have such a lack of now. I went on it pretty hard about the Harry and the Hendersons episode, but what is wrong with a feel-good movie that you don't have to have everything spelled out for you? Just take the ride, man. Take the ride.
Yeah, I said to you off air, you know, I'm pretty good at, there's a button in my brain when I know that I need to just take the ride with a movie, and I'm happy to hit that button. It doesn't always have to be deep. I don't need the backstories of every single character. Right. You know, and this is a very simple story, but very clever and well-written, good script. And throw in Steve Guttenberg and a few other great people here and there as well, and some top-notch effects, and some genuinely funny scripting, you know, along the way. Heartfelt as well.
Yeah, I love that he latches on to the Three Stooges.
Yep.
And you kind of get to see a playoff of that later on in the show, like when they send the other military robots to come take him down. And, you know, he outsmarts them because he has human intelligence and knows how to build a snare and all this kind of stuff to trap them. And he rewires them and they become robotic Three Stooges. I mean...
I should imagine he also watched a lot of Wile E. Coyote and other Warner Looney Tunes movie cartoons as well, because, yeah, he seems to be heavily influenced by that type of comedy, doesn't he?
He was full of the pop culture of that time period, the stuff that was on TV while we were growing up. I'm a little older than you, so, yeah, I mean, Three Stooges were on every day when I was a kid, and... Yeah, he's just taking all of that and rolling it together and becomes his own person, just like we all do. Those miniature influences all mixed together is It's who we are.
He just does it over the course of a couple of weeks rather than, you know, 10, 12 years until you start realizing what kind of a person you are.
But I think I caught it a while ago is when Gutenberg's character finally catches up with him and they go up to the mountains and spend some time together. She makes the point of, I think he speaks really well for a 4 year or a 4 day old. So he's only 4 days in at that point. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about the cast. We got Gutenberg. I mean, when you talk about mid 80s, is there anybody that was hitting it any more than Steve Gutenberg?
Yeah, he's been in some of my favorites from this era. You know, I'm a big fan of the Police Academy movies, especially the ones he was in. The Cocoon movies, Three Men and a Baby, Three Men and a Lady, you know, and there's you mentioned one the other day.
Bad
Medicine, that was it. he is a charming, funny, could deliver the lines, you know, every man, but also... I don't know. He had that magic. There's a glint in his eye. You know, he's just very good at what he does.
Yeah. I mean, he's, you don't confuse him for anybody else. You know, he's kind of his own thing. And I can't think of anybody else that even kind of fits that category. I think they tried to bring other people in and kind of shoehorn them in there. He's kind of like Bill Murray light. He's like Bill Murray cute. Right.
Yeah, because he can be sarcastic, but he does it in a really charming way.
Yeah.
Whereas Bill Murray can be quite cutting.
Oh, yeah. since we're talking about Gutenberg and Police Academy, we got G.W. Bailey in this as well, right? I mean, he's pretty one-dimensional. Always has been.
Yes.
He pretty much plays the same character all the time, but nobody does it better.
If you need an a-hole who works for the police or the military and is a bit too big for their boots, then G.W. Bailey is your man. You know, whether it's in Police Academy or even in Mannequin. Now, we talked about Mannequin together. So this is our second G.W. Bailey discussion. In fact, I have a theory that when he gets fired at the end of Short Circuit, he then goes on to work in the department store as a security guard, changes his name. Because he's exactly that, like that character, really.
Yeah.
You know.
Still over the top, even for the job that he's in, right?
Today.
We got Ally Sheedy. I mean, one of the Brat Pack here stepping up.
Yeah.
How am I going to say this? It's not a spectacular performance.
No, but she's cute.
But she's cute. I mean, she plays it perfect. But. Yeah. I guess I was used to seeing a little more out of her. And this one's kind of dialed back for that character. She's a little more airheadish, but that's fine. She's playing the part for what she wanted to be. I saw an interview. She said she always wanted to be in a movie like this where it was more fantasized, you know, dealing with, you know, those kind of subjects. So, you know, I'm not saying she did a bad job. It's just, I don't know. I've seen her do some things that make me go, wow, okay.
I guess all of the cast knew they were going into a movie where they knew that the main star really was going to be this 1.5 million special effect.
Good point. Yeah.
You know, so they knew that was going to be front and center. But
all right. And we'll talk about the elephant in the room.
Oh boy.
Fisher Stevens. I'll be honest with you. I had never seen Fisher Stevens before this movie, so I didn't know he didn't talk this way.
Yes. I think that was a revelation for a lot of people when they realized he was not an Indian gentleman, not a South Asian gentleman. He is in fact a white guy. But yeah, I mean, it's the elephant in the room. It, you know, let's call it what it is. He's brown facing it. You know, he went for the job. He got the job. This was 86, probably 85. Yeah. This film was shot maybe even earlier that it started, you know, getting put together. He went into this, you know, he went and lived in India for 3 years, for 3 months, not 3 years, that's commitment, 3 months, to learn the culture. And he actually wanted to try and portray the character as less of a stereotype, but the studio pushed him to become the comedic side, you know, sidekick. It's incredibly funny performance, but yeah, it wouldn't fly, you know.
It's just a different time, of course. You know? Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things, right? And you know, even in this situation, like I said, if I didn't know any different, I mean, most of them, if you go back into the 60s and 70s, it's pretty obvious that this person is not this nationality, you know, where, yeah. With him, I was shocked when I found out that he wasn't. So
yeah, I mean, he does a brilliant job. And he's, I think he's a very memorable character. You know?
Sure.
Maybe that's shocking to say, but I'm a big fan of it. Obviously, yes, okay, you could say he was taking away the role from somebody who was actually from that part of the world, but
he was an actor. You didn't have access back then like you
did.
I mean, you just didn't. Bollywood was not at the level that it is now. You didn't have all the way that we're all connected. You stuck with who you had and who you used, and you were either in the system or you weren't in the system, and you know, it was just a different time.
And the character was popular enough that it was more or less front and center in the sequel.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? I mean, the whole sequel is his.
It's just him and number five, and then Fred, the other guy that's in it. I can't remember now his name. But yeah, no, but it is the elephant in the room, and good job we talked about it. But
yeah. How about the fact that G.W. Bailey's name is Scroder? Which is very close to another word that when they say it, sometimes you're like, I think they called him Scrotum that time.
I'm pretty sure that Fisher Stevens says it at one point.
Oh, so, but yeah, man, I don't know how you want to approach this. I haven't done a show with somebody in a while. I don't know if we want to kind of walk through it, but it starts off with a big military showcase. They've got funders there that's going to back this program. They're showing off the robots. They're doing some incredible things. Yeah. And they want to meet Newton.
Newton Crosby.
Yep.
The reluctant genius.
Yeah. He's not there to rub elbows with people. What do they keep saying?
Hobnobbing.
Yeah. And he's tucked away in his room, and he's basically, hey, come on, man. I mean, Jarvis?
Yeah.
He had Jarvis back then, man.
Yeah, he did. flipping people off.
Yeah. So that's the first thing I thought of when I saw it. I was like, oh, look at this. He's teaching
him to play the piano, isn't he?
Yeah. One-handed.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, Gutenberg, you know, he's not really played a character like this, I guess. You know, he's a bit of a recluse, a bit of a hermit, a genius. You know, a lot of geniuses are like that, I guess, you hear. And, yeah, he's you know, everybody wants to meet the man that created these robots, and I think partly the reason he's like that is because he knows that they're going to be used to kill a bunch of people, you know, in these wars, and he just wants to take his money and run. You know, he feels bad about it. He's guilty, you know.
Sure.
So, but yes,
and you know, out of that, you know, you got funders that say, oh, we won't. I'll probably invest my money once I get to meet him and understand the person that's building all this. And so our leadership in the military is trying to find him and get him out there to hobnob. And, yeah, it's just not his thing. While this is going on, they're doing some great displays of what these robots can do, even, you know, mixing the gin and tonic, you know. So these things are.
I know. It's like we've shown you all these explosions and stuff on the field. And now the ultimate selling point will be. This robot can mix me a gin and tonic, shaken but not stirred.
And, I mean, they're talking like Cylons, so I kind of dig that. You kind of get the panel that's over the power button that's kind of reminiscent of what the Terminator sees.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you've got all these elements that are all mixed into this thing, but the fact that you're taking these killing machines that their eyes light up red and they're shooting lasers off their shoulder pack and... Now they're mixing you a drink. Hey.
And they, of course, they use the sound effect from the Ghostbusters proton pack.
Yeah.
For the lasers. And they do look a bit like something you'd see in James Cameron's first Terminator movie, or maybe even the second one. You know, there is something about them with the wheel treads. You know, they're not walking. They've got little tank treads and stuff, you know. So, yeah, they're pretty badass.
Yeah. And the fact of, because this is going back to probably R2-D2 or whatever, but... You know, in most cases, you're going to see the character, but not the whole character, right? You're just going to see an arm or, you know, the wheels or, you're literally seeing these things rolling around and doing things and reacting. And yeah, I mean, it's impressive, man. It really is. To think about 1986, you haven't really seen anything like this before that wasn't a motorized machine that you stuck a person in to move the legs, you know?
Yeah.
You know, silent.
Yeah, running. No, there was no, no lying to the audience. You know, this was a real machine, and it was, you know, they built, I don't know how many of these they probably built, you know, arms here for close-ups, eyes, you know, and I know they built obviously probably about 10 of the actual robots. Like I said, they spent a tenth of the budget, $15 million back then. You know, it's nothing these days on the movies.
Right.
$15 million, and they spent 1.5 on the robots, you know, and it was worth it. Yeah. I think I had to get that right.
Again, but believing in the character, and when you see that it's rolling around and you don't see wires running to it or things are, and I'm sure there's some hidden things. That's just, you know, that's part of the movie magic. But I still say this is impressive, man. We saw such a change in effects around 92, 93. It really started getting interesting. You know, you can say, you know, DreamWorks or whoever, ILM, you know, getting involved and pushing everybody beyond what's been the norm. And this is the result you get. Now it's all CGI, which, don't get me wrong, there's some things that work great. But this is a real robot running around. You know, I'm sure that you overdub things, the voice and all that kind of stuff for sure. But still, it's so impressive.
And it's all in camera. Any tricks they needed to do, they were all in camera. You know, like when he's flipping a coin or whatever it is. And, you know, they're doing, there's lots of things they do where it's all real, you know.
Yeah.
And anything they couldn't do, apparently they just used a hand, like a robot hand, and then would just do a close-up of it already attached to, like, winding a window down or something like that, you know. So they worked around it, and it worked really, really well. But whilst Steve Guttenberg is hobnobbing with these military guys who want to blast these Russians, they're packing away the five robots, aren't they, Ricky? And there's a bit of a thunderstorm rolling in.
Sure enough.
Uh-oh. Lightning strikes.
They forget to disconnect one of them.
Oh, boy.
And there you go. The lightning strikes. And now he's feeling different. Once. And
he starts malfunctioning a little bit, doesn't he?
Just a little bit. Well, the first thing he sees is a female robot. We're assuming it's a female robot that goes by with a nice voice and, I guess you say, a nice tail.
I mean, I guess that was the joke. He's like, oh, he just follows it. But then it's quite comical. Then he kind of gets bumped by the garbage bins and then he's put into the back of a garbage truck and he's sort of, where am I? What's going on? You know, it's one of those classic sort of knocked from one place to the other. And
sure.
So manages to escape the facility.
Yep. Breaks the barricade. He's out there and nobody can really track him. So they call in Guttenberg. We got to find this unit. You know, it could be out there shooting people or whatever. So they're in their mind. This is a killing machine that's out there in civilian world. And, you know, he kind of gets knocked off the truck. Looks like he's at a farm.
Yeah, he lands in a field of cows, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Just like Gwildor in Masters of the Universe trying to communicate with cows. And he sees a butterfly, doesn't he? And he's really entranced by this butterfly. And you realize he appreciates beauty. He's becoming alive. He's becoming self-aware. Yeah. All the meanwhile, in contrast to that, the military, like you say, they're panicking because not only do they realize he's missing and he's worth millions, somebody says, well, at least he hasn't got any, you know, any ammunition or lasers. And they're like, what are you talking about? He's fully armed to the teeth with lasers and grenades and goodness knows what else. So we need to find him before he fries someone.
Right. And that's where we get Schroeder involved.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they try to communicate with Five. They get Newton to reach out to him and try to, you know, find a location for him, try to shut him down. None of it's working. And I love the scene where he sends back the, I'm a pepper, you're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
What is he saying? He's saying, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
It's just a sign that he saw on the side of like a barn or something.
He's just reading it out to himself, isn't he?
So it's got plenty of that kind of humor of trying to decipher something meaning something, and it means absolutely nothing, you know? And again, it's one of those things I miss. Everything doesn't have to mean something.
Yeah.
You know,
he's not reading like a page from, I don't know, some really deep philosophical book and
right.
Understand. He's just reading a Dr. Pepper advertisement on the side of the road. You know, that's all it is.
Again, reaching into that pop culture of the time, you know?
Yeah. I don't think I'd heard of Dr. Pepper until this movie over here. Anyway, in the UK, we didn't get it. You know, well, I mean, it might have been around, but it was certainly not a very talked about drink. It was because of this and the Cannibal Run movie that I started understanding, oh, there's a drink called Dr. Pepper. And then I think we started getting it a little bit easier over here. And
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, that's like, I think I was born with a Dr. Pepper. So,
I mean, it's my second favorite fizzy beverage after Cherry Coke. So I'll always like Dr. Pepper. Got some fond memories of drinking that in cinemas as a kid.
Heck yeah. Yeah, it was my go-to, and until I had kidney stones, I was like, you know, maybe I ought to back off.
Put the pepper down.
That's right. Dr. Pepper time. Yeah, man, then you get from here to, we meet Ally Sheedy's character, Stephanie, who is trying to do her own business, a snack mobile, I guess you would say.
Yeah, Stephanie's Snack Shack.
Yeah, so it's a snack shop on wheels. She comes home and her boyfriend / ex-boyfriend, not really sure what the term is at the time, is trying to get the dog off the roof, or either he put the dog on the roof. He's trying to get it and capture it, right, and put it into a cage.
Yeah, because he wants to sell it to a lab who are going to just test on it. And he is such a lowlife that he's willing to steal his ex-girlfriend's dog and sell it to a laboratory for a few $1,000s. And she, to further emphasize her pure good character, not only is she sort of serving people food in her snack shop, she's also rescued every animal in the vicinity. She has pet raccoons, dogs, chickens, cats. You know, she's like Ace Ventura. Her house is just full of animals.
She's like my wife.
Well, we all know someone like that. You know, my mum was the same. Every cat in the neighborhood would be in my mum's kitchen. You know, she had budgies, fish. It was just that. Yeah, we definitely all know somebody like that. In your case, it's your lovely wife. And there's people like that who just don't want to. They want to help everything and help everyone, you know.
They don't feel that connection with people so much, so it's the animals that they get it from. And I mean, we at in the evening time around 6 o'clock, you'll see a, I don't even know what you call a group of skunks.
a stink of skunks. I'm
a
gonna
stink
say.
Of skunks. They'll start hobbling. You'll see them coming across the fields, going to the barn, because they know that she's going to throw some cat food out for them to eat. They will come out of the wild
guys,
for her to throw them cat food. So.
Looking at their watches. Hey, guys, you know what time it is?
Yeah, as soon as they see the sun coming down, you'll see them start hopping.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, she just loves animals. I mean, I could go on and on with the possums, the raccoons, the, you know, the multitude of cats, the 9 donkeys we have.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it is. It is. That's why I have to work 3 jobs.
Those damn donkeys.
Oh.
Well, he's got her ex-boyfriend's got this amazing red Trans Am.
Oh, yeah.
That she calls the Dorkmobile, doesn't she?
And I'm like, that's anything but a Dorkmobile.
She tells him, go get in your Dorkmobile and leave me alone.
Yeah.
So he does. They have a bit of a fight. He's quite physical with her. Again, this was a different time. You know, a couple of times in this movie, he gets quite physical with her.
Yeah, he throws her down on the ground. And I'm like, Wow. Yeah. I'm surprised with that, actually. So
I mean, later on, he shows up with a shotgun, doesn't he? <It's like>, crikey.
Well, again, showing how low life he is. I mean, that was
a reason he's the ex, I guess.
Right. You know. Right.
Cool car, though.
Oh, yeah. The car is fantastic. While it's still together. Hint, hint. So at this point, now you've got, you know, Newton and Ben, which is the Fisher Stevens character, setting up some road trips, trying to find the other robot. And they take number one with them, the number one robot, in case there's any, you know, yeah, in case there's any altercations whatsoever, they've got some backup. And, you know, they don't have a whole lot of luck.
They don't. They really don't. And it's really funny, actually. They do work well together. They've obviously worked, I mean, their characters have obviously worked together for a long time because they understand each other's quirks. Mm-hmm. And they even have like a little language and they keep chipping in and finishing each other's sentences. You know, when he says, machines don't think, they don't laugh, they don't feel, they don't do this. They just run programming. And they always follow that last right. sentence with each other, you know. Yeah. So they definitely work together. But yeah, they do not have a lot of luck.
Yeah.
Both probably don't have a lot of luck with the ladies either, you know, you get the feeling.
Well, and that's the Ben character's like, maybe we can find some females, you know.
Females.
Did she shove her tongue down your throat? I mean, you know, his questioning is just like, wow, you really do not get out, do you? So yeah, when we talk about nerds, and again, that's an 80s thing, man. The computer nerds.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's kind of the epitome of that in this movie as well. He could have fit into Lambda, Lambda, Lambda very well.
Yeah, I can imagine him in the background of War Games or something as well, you know?
Oh, it's funny you say that, right? Did you say that on purpose or?
I didn't know.
Okay, the director actually did War Games.
Oh, really? Wow, yeah. Okay.
And Saturday Night Fever.
I know he did Saturday Night Fever. That's crazy, you know. John Travolta and Johnny Five, two Johnnies.
Yep.
But very different.
Yep.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah. John Badham is the director. Not John Bonham. I mean.
John Badham.
Yeah. Badham.
Now, what I really like is now number five makes his way to Stephanie's farm.
Yeah.
And this, again, harkens back to the 80s, where I guess in some ways we still are obsessed with aliens, you know. But pop culture back then, Stephanie would have seen Close Encounters or E.T. And she sees there's somebody outside in her, you know, in her snack shack. And, of course, the gate, the little shutters open and you've got these glowing red eyes and this little face. She's like, welcome to Earth.
Welcome to our planet.
Stephanie. And she goes in. She's so brave. Like she's taking in all the raccoons. I'm going to take this alien in. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. She knows who the real bad people are. And, you know, that's the warmongers. Right. So, yeah, again, that's that mentality. But, yeah, not taking away. She plays the character what it needs to be. Right. Because it has to be this caring person who wears their heart on their sleeve. That knows they're doing the right thing, willing to take anybody in and take care of them. And it just works. And at this point, that's where she's finding out he's not an alien. He's a robot. She sees the badge on him, where to call. And she calls to say, hey, I found this robot, I think.
I think he's like, one of yours.
Yeah. Is there any money for this?
And the guy's like, no, but we do offer tours of the facility. And we could even throw in like maybe a soda or something. It's like, come on, guys. This thing's worth millions. Just give her a few $100.
Right. But obviously she ends up falling and having, you know, some feelings for him as he goes along. And of course you're doing the learning thing. And again, this harkens back to E.T. I think about, you know, Elliot, you know, showing the Star Wars figures and the planets and just trying to give them anything she can to say, here's things you should just know. These are things that are important in my life that you should know as well.
He reads like every book in her house in 20 minutes. So yeah. She's like, what else can I? Ah, the television. So television. She puts that on and he goes crazy, especially because he can change the channels with himself with his own antenna. So he's watching like 3 seconds of everything, just like almost watching every channel at the same time. And we should probably mention something which I really love about this movie at this point. The first time we hear DeBarge's song.
Yep.
Who's Johnny? Johnny? What a tune. What a tune. Then the famously the video for this song.
Yep.
I don't know why Steve Guttenberg didn't want to appear in it. Maybe he was busy with the Police Academy movie, but they're all in this, even the robot briefly, but there's a cardboard cutout of him. Just, and I always remember that as a kid thinking, why is Steve Guttenberg just a cardboard cutout?
Yeah. You know, maybe Guns N' Roses should have done that. Remember when they did the Don't You Cry Tonight video, and Izzy had just left the band and they held up a sign that said, where's Izzy? Could have just had a cardboard cutout of him up there.
Well, this song is important because later on it will help Number Five decide on his own name, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And it's a cool name, Johnny Five, you know.
That's so cool, you know, El DeBarge was in a band called DeBarge, which had a few hits of their own. The rhythm
of the night. You know that song is close to my heart because that song,
Last Dragon.
Of course. Yeah. You knew where I was going. You read my mind. You've got the glow. Well,
we kind of got close to the same mind. I'm sorry.
We do.
But yeah, I mean, so you go from, I've always wondered about that. Well, we were DeBarge, but now I'm El DeBarge. So you're the DeBarge?
I'm the Barge.
It's kind of, it's very Spinal Tapish name thing, because remember they were in a band called what were they called? Dang, I went blank.
It's been a while since I've seen Spinal Tap. But they did have a funny name change, I do remember.
Yeah. The Originals. They were in a band called The Originals, and they left and put another band called The New Originals together.
It's kind of like when you get like a Jason movie that's like the final chapter, and then the next one is The New Beginning. Like, well, hang on a minute.
Didn't see that.
The New Originals. Come on.
The New Originals. Yeah, I'm El DeBarge. So anyway, it don't matter. He had a big hit with this, and I really don't remember him doing anything after that. So
no.
Maybe he should have just stayed with the DeBarge. I don't know.
He should have done.
Yeah. Oh, well. I think they were all brothers and sisters, too. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there was a family resemblance between them, for sure.
They had another group called the Jets back then that were all family, too. So I may be getting those a little confused because they're almost the same thing. So, anywho, doesn't matter. We've got this song in this movie for a reason, and it is used for a purpose.
Yeah. Twice we get it. Once now and once towards the end when he's, you know, almost accepted. It's almost like he's signing the, I'm now a human being, you know. I'm a member of the United States. And what's my name going to be?
I want to be a Mark or a Jeff or a...
Johnny. I like that.
So, yeah, I mean, from here on, you've got, you know, our crew that's trying to capture Number Five and kind of keep him together, but you got Scroder.
You can call him Scrotum.
Who really is trying to destroy it.
He's like a kid with a catapult, or, you know, he's just itching to have the chance to destroy this, you know, and he's got his cronies following him around, and he's just like he is in Police Academy, you know, any chance to flex his power. And when he gets told, you need to go out and bring this thing in, don't destroy it. And he says to his men, destroy it if you have to. And they're like, yeah. And then everyone's like, woo, we're going on a mission. But they're really inept. They're like the Keystone Cops, you know. They're driving in their tank lorry thing, and they can't see Number Five. And then they realize that they bumped into him, and he's attached to the front of their vehicle.
Great scene.
They panic when he looks around at them, and then he falls off a bridge, and it's lots of fun stuff, like stuff you saw.
He kind of does a Dukes of Hazzard kind of.
He does.
But yeah, I mean, you get several occurrences where he leaves Stephanie's, he comes back to Stephanie's, and you get all these situations. I love where he makes Ben and the other guy get out of the van for the first time. That's when he decides he's going to drive. Well, actually, he drives at Stephanie's, right? Because he takes the manual out and goes through the manual that's real quick. Right. But when he gets in that one, you know, he's reaching out, moving the mirror, getting it all set.
He does the sort of pointing forward thing, doesn't he? Yeah. He's very confident now.
Yeah.
At Stephanie's as well, as we touched on earlier, you know, he sees a grasshopper. He's learning about all the bugs. And, and he accidentally crushes. He's mimicking a grasshopper. And it, like a child, you know, joyful. You know, I've got 2 2-year-olds and I know exactly what this is like. He's, and you're a dad, you know, and you see this joyful, oh, wow, this creature. And then they accidentally kill it. And he kills this. And he just looks at her and says, oh, just reassemble it. She says, what do you mean reassemble it? You've squashed it. It's dead. And he's like, no, disassemble. What? Disassemble? Reassemble? And she's like, no, when something's dead, it's dead. And then that's exactly like you said earlier. He starts piecing together. Death is death.
Yeah.
And I was designed to cause death. And then that further powers his little robot brain into thinking, you know, my destiny, I'm in charge of what I need to be doing, what I want to do. It's a great little plot point. You don't see it coming, you know. You don't see it coming in a movie like this. It's especially in a moment where he's learning about butterflies and bugs and raccoons, and then suddenly he just crashes on.
Yeah. I mean, that's again the beauty of this film is you get invested in the character, and then you find out the real feelings behind all of it. It's just like you said earlier. It's brilliant filmmaking, brilliant storytelling. And it's very much like you said, he's a child. He's learning as a child. And you're seeing that. You just brought up a great example. You know, if you have kids, this is what you experience. You have to stop and explain. No, don't grab the cat around the neck. Because either it's going to go crazy and you're going to be in bad shape, or you're going to kill it, you know.
Don't crush that snail. That's what I have to say to my son. I know you like to, you can pick them up. You can look at the snail, but don't squeeze it, because if you break the shell, you're gonna kill it.
Yeah,
and you're gonna be upset.
Yeah. And sadly, till one of those things kind of happens, they don't feel that inside, right?
Yeah, it's tough love, tough lessons. And
I'm not going against any of our hunting friends out there, but for me, it was kind of that same experience. I got a BB gun going out. What are you supposed to do with a BB gun? Are you supposed to shoot birds? First time I shot a bird and it fell dead, I was done.
Really?
I felt terrible and couldn't do it again. And, you know, I understand the need of being able to hunt for yourselves in case things get in, the crap hits the fan.
The zombies. You gotta be able to support, you know.
Right? So you got to be able to, but going out and doing it because you can, I'm not a big fan of it. But hey, each their own.
I mean, it's, you know what it's like here in the United Kingdom. You would have heard about all the fox hunting, etc. And it's, you know, not to the same extent, obviously, but there is a very small fox hunting culture. And not many people here would agree with it. There's a very small, it's the high, very rich and powerful that get involved in that kind of thing. You know, I know it's different over there, but I totally agree with you, my friend. Totally agree with you.
Now, we do have a problem here with deer. Because deer, we're overpopulated with deer. So if we don't have hunters going out and taking care of that, you're going to have a lot more people getting killed in car accidents and stuff like that. So, you know, there is a trade-off for that. I get it. But going and killing a caribou just because you can, I don't get that. So, again, that's my opinion. You can do what you want, right?
For sure.
But I mean, that's that moment that makes what happens in this movie relatable, is because I can go back and say, oh, I've done that. And I remember how that made me feel. You know, I had no right to just shoot an animal that was just going about their day, you know, doing their thing. So made me sad.
But when you're a kid, you know, you've got to learn these, like you said, and he's basically a kid, you know, he's just learning at an accelerated rate, really, isn't he?
He's learning way more than I did at 4 days old, that's for sure. I mean, I was drinking Dr. Pepper, but, you know.
And you like to be a pepper too? He also walks in on Stephanie in the bathtub.
Nice software.
Even as a kid, I got that joke. I get that. Because he sees her and he says, Stephanie, you changed color. Beautiful. Nice software.
All of a sudden, he sounds like Pauly Shore. What was that all about? I don't
know. Sorry about that.
Wait, Azo. Stephanie.
Hey, Stephanie Fonzie. I don't know. I've turned him to somebody else now. So, yeah, he understands. Perhaps even that is helping him to understand that humans, you know, wear clothes and you know, and the difference between him and them and life and death and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, it's all learning for him. Yeah, he steals her truck, though, doesn't he? And he drives off in her truck.
It's a great scene. It's great.
He's driving off. And again, I think Who's Johnny comes on again at this point, and he's like, yeah.
Yeah, he's rocking out at this point because he's going through, like, some, like, radio evangelist and some news reports, and then he gets to the music, and then he starts grooving, right?
Yeah. And then he realizes he's got a tracker on him.
Yeah.
And that's how the army keep finding him. So he pulls his tracker off.
Throws it to the local window. Redneck. Yeah. Throws back it back in the truck.
I wasn't going to use the term redneck, but I guess they are rednecks, let's be honest.
Oh, yeah.
I like it when they get pulled over later. And if you carefully listen to the wife, because these are like quite, you know, they're late, mid to late 60s, these two. Fairly, you know, unassuming, but she sort of says to him, I hope you haven't got the grass in the glove box.
Yeah, I hope you took the grass out of the the glove box. Then the cop says, she says, something wrong, officer?
It's so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's pretty clever. He's learning again, you know, and he understands what's going on now, and that they're tracking him, and that they want to disassemble him. This is the whole point, I guess, really, is that he knows they want to catch him, to disassemble him and study him and find out what's happened. Because as far as the army know, he's still malfunctioning. You know, no one except Stephanie really knows that he's alive. But the TV reporters get hold of this news and they put it all over the news. And there is a big reward being offered. And who is watching the news in his local bar but Stephanie's ex-boyfriend, the douchebag? And he says, oh, she's going to give me that money, all right. I think is it 25,000 dollars.
Right.
He says to her later on, don't worry, I'll give you five. It's like, you piece of.
he jumps in his Dortmobile, drives out to her house. This is where he has the shotgun, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, because he busts in the house and he's trying to, you know, take Johnny, because Johnny, he was not Johnny at this time. He's still number five. But that's where he goes outside and disassembles the car.
Well, just before that, you get him wooing. And now I understand why. Now you've reminded me why they are referencing, you know, Saturday Night Fever in this, you know, because he's watching John Travolta and he starts copying the moves. And this scene is so good. The effects while he's doing the dance moves. How did they even do that, you know? It's no miniatures. That's a real robot doing some of these dance moves.
Yeah,
and then he starts doing the Bee Gees, doesn't he? More than a woman. And she's like falling in love with him almost. Not in a Howard the Duck kind of way. That was pushing the boundaries. But the less said about that scene, the better. But but she is kind of like realizing that, like, this is his charming robot. And we're having a dance and he's spinning me around the room and it's all very lovely. But
well,
yeah,
look at the man that she used to have as a boyfriend and how he treated her. Now she's with a robot who treats her better than a human does.
He's making her breakfast, Ricky.
Yeah,
he might be burning it, but he's trying, you know.
Still a little lumpy.
And I love all of that stuff he does where he quotes, like, commercials he's watched, you know, can of soup, a meal in itself. Yeah. You know, even at the end when he's doing the, oh, shucks, little lady, John Wayne stuff. All of that is so good. So ahead of its time, you know.
Yep.
We see it all the time now where people are quoting things like Jim Carrey was doing it in his movies, you know. But back then, it was just like, wow, this guy is like, it's like a beacon for pop culture, this robot. I love it.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. That's why I think, I mean, as a kid, you go, wow, this is a cool kind of robot, and he's, you know, hopping like a grasshopper and all this stuff. But tying in all the pop culture stuff of the time, that kind of gets the teenage group involved going, all right, this is, you know, this is kind of cool. You know, what a, such a different idea.
Yeah,
man, this thing across the board is just smart. It's a smart movie.
And yeah, you're right. The Dortmobile gets disassembled.
Oh, man.
He does it in like 30 seconds.
And he comes out. The
Trans Am is just in pieces.
He's holding up a drum rotor in his hand, right? Or he just happens to be holding it. And dude is shooting at him, and he's blocking the bullets like Wonder Woman.
And he's making Bruce Lee noises, isn't he? He's going,
whoa. Well, that's a little later on, isn't it?
Oh, is that later on, is it?
That's when he confronts him, and he starts using the laser cut the drive shaft. That's which, right. Looking at that, I kind of want to go back and watch that part again, because I'm going, how did they pull this off? I mean, obviously it's a rotoscope laser coming through, but he's holding this drive shaft, and it starts breaking off in sections with smoke and stuff coming out of it. You know, where the lasers are hitting it, hitting it down shorter. I'm like, because he was going to go over and whack him over the head with it. And I'm still scratching my head of how did they pull that off? I'm just trying to think of the assembly of the drive shaft to where you don't see any breaks in it.
Yeah, they must have had little...
And they're just going to start falling off, you know.
Little mini explosions or something going off. Yeah, I don't know. It's... Yeah, it's really good. And like we said, when he flips the washers and the nuts from the...
Yeah.
But that was apparently done with fishing wire. But you just don't see it. You know, it's just done so well.
Yeah. But yeah, that's when he starts zapping the laser. And the last he does is when he shoots his belt buckle and it makes his pants fall down.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And then he's humiliated. She laughs so hard.
Yeah, she's laughing, yeah.
And he runs off, and she's in love with this robot even more. You know, he's just saved her as well.
Right.
So Johnny and Stephanie then decide we do need contact, you know, Ben, Fisher Stevens' character, and the Gutmeister, the Gut himself. and we need to meet with them. We need to, so they go and talk in a bar, and little did they know that Schroeder and all of his cronies are disguised as various people around the bar listening into their conversation.
Right.
And he's sort of saying to her, I know it might seem convincing, but he's really looking at her like a bimbo, isn't he? He's like, come on, it's just a robot. She's like, no, you don't get it. He's, you know, he's real, you know, something's changed. He's definitely. And then they're approached by Schroeder and et cetera. And they sort of say, thanks for leading us to her. And she thinks she's been duped by Steve Guttenberg, you know?
Right.
And, they were, and he's fallen in love with this woman in minutes.
Well, that's kind of how it happens. You know, when you're locked up with robots all the time, you meet one woman, you're like, I think I love her.
This is a real woman.
So, yeah, I mean, you get this where she feels betrayed. They kind of go back again to her place again. There's a lot of back and forth to her place that happens quite a bit. But it ends up leading to where they get back together with Guttenberg, and they drive off out in the mountains, which looks like a scene from Krull.
Yeah.
When you look at that mountainscape, it's like, wow. It kind of
also reminds me of the Blue Shadows on the Trail scene from Three Amigos, you know, where they're just sitting around.
Blue Shadows on the Trail. Ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. Good night, Dad. That scene.
No reason for the turtle and the horse to join in, but hey, it was an 80s movie and we just went along with it.
My wife loves that scene. She loved the night, Ned, the turtle, you know.
My favorite scene is, for no reason at all, is the singing bush or whatever it is.
Oh, man. Yeah,
I just, and when he shoots the Invisible Swordsman, cracks me up so much. Right.
We're gonna have to revisit and do Three Amigos.
You're on.
Okay, all right. That'll happen.
We get a shootout as well, don't we? Because the other, this is badass now, and he's really like confident at taking these guys out. Like you said earlier, he's learned a lot of tricks from being around humans, and he's doing all these fun quotes as well. He's like, escape robot fights for his life, film at 11. And he's doing all these sort of John Wayne things, and then we get the "Hey, Laser Lips, your mother was a snowblower," which we used to say on the playground.
Oh,
all the
yeah,
time. You know,
yeah.
It's
classic.
So, I know. Yeah. And then he stooges them. He totally stooges them. He rewires them all.
Yeah, I mean, takes the three of them and rewires them, and they show up with the military looking for them, and they're all slapping each other and giving each other the eye pokes and doing the whole Three Stooges, you know, shindig there, which is still, again, it's incredible, because now you got three of these things, and you only see them from waist up, but they are like prodding the eyes and reacting and
ducking down and slapping.
To make these things have emotion is one thing, you know, but when you can tie that into them having emotion and being able to see the whole robots and all that stuff, again, I can't say it enough. You forget that you're looking at a special effect. You're thinking, yep, that's a robot.
And it's because it's funny. It's just genuinely funny. Sure. You know, he's saying, you know, you waskily wabbits, and he's saying all this stuff while he's doing all of this. You know, it's just funny. You're just going with it. It's too much, right. Really. Maybe it's a distraction, but the effects, the humor, it all works well together, and you're just going along with the ride.
Right. And so Gutenberg finally realizes that he does have real emotions when he tells him the joke.
He tells him a joke and he laughs.
And he finally gets it, and he laughs and laughs and laughs. And he's like, wow, he does have emotions, and that joke wasn't even that funny.
I messed up the punchline
punchline. So, yeah. So at this point, now he's on board.
Yeah.
And then we get the turnaround, which happens in every one of these movies, where the bad part happens. They've got them surrounded. It's now Stephanie and Newton.
Ben?
I think they're the only two.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm there.
And then, of course, number five's in the back.
Yep.
And they get stopped by the military, and the boss of Newton as well is there saying, hey, you just need to, you know, walk away. Let us get with the robot. We'll take it in. And that's not the plan at all. It's almost a Nightbreed scene, right? He's got a gun.
Yeah.
So as soon as they clear out, then they just, you know, and then right when they're getting ready to do that, all of a sudden you see the back doors fly open, and number five goes rolling out across the desert.
Goes for his life, flying along. And you
he
hear him sort of going,
yippee! When
yeah,
he
does.
Up.
He does.
Yeehaw!
And again, this scene now, you know, if you, as a kid, you know, you can imagine, don't know how old you were when you saw this, but like I said, I was probably 9, 10, maybe the oldest. Broke my heart as a child. I didn't understand, you know, until it's revealed later on. They tell us what they do to him. The army
they
just
shoot him with a helicopter, blow him up.
they do a grizzly on him.
They do a grizzly on him.
and he is exploded beyond reassemble. There is nothing left of this robot. You know, and Stephanie breaks down, you know. Ali Sheedy's fantastic at this point, you know.
Yeah.
And even Gutenberg sort of gives her his big, hairy, manly chest to lean against, you know.
Right.
And even at that point, he's sort of thinking with his actual head, you know, this time he's like, okay, yeah, she's actually really hurting. I've got to look after her. And they get in the van, they drive off. And he talks about, my dad left me 40 acres in Montana. I'm probably just going to retire from robotics and go live there now.
Yeah.
And then you hear a voice.
Yep. And he's in that always obvious hidden compartment in the bottom of a, you know, work van.
These military
opens
guys.
Up and he comes out of it, which you look at the depth of the van, you're like, yeah, I don't think that would happen.
And then just in case the audience don't get it, Gutenberg says, he might as well look at the camera when he says this. He says, wow, he created a duplicate of himself out of parts.
Right.
Kids, don't worry. That wasn't the real J5.
Right. Yep, he just sent a decoy out there to be destroyed. So they think they killed him. And now he can go live in Montana.
Yeah.
With Newton and Stephanie.
And all the animals.
She's going to get all the animals. They're going to live together. And you get this great scene where they're in the back, and he's like, you two work this out. I'll start driving.
Yeah.
And again, he throws the seat out of the vehicle. which is a very small seat when you look at it. The one he throws out, out there, he's like, yeah, that's not really the seat. But anywho, it makes the point. But he straightens the mirror, taking off again.
And this time he says, yo.
But yeah, I mean, this is, like, that's why I keep saying E.T. kind of the same thing, right? When E.T. gets real sick and they've got him in that incubator looking thing, and they got the stuck, you know, the sticker things all over him, and Elliot's sick too, and traumatizing. So yeah. That was 82. I was, well, it was 81. Was it 81 or 82?
81, E.T. I think. E.T. So same I was, year as, the
was 10 years old when I saw that, and it broke me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the first movie that made me cry. And of course, you know, as it turns around, everything's okay. Same thing for you, right? Because you're right at the same age with this movie.
I couldn't believe what I'd just seen, you know? Yeah. Well, I actually said to my wife, she was watching with me, she'd never seen it before. You know, she's turning a bit young. He was younger than me again. And she don't think she'd ever seen it before. And I said to her at that point, I said, don't worry, he's okay. She went, oh my God, I was going to say. And I said, well, the thing is, and she doesn't mind me, doesn't mind me spoiling things like that. But I said, but can you imagine what a terrible thing to do to a child in a parental guidance rated movie over here? You know, when a kid's renting that out from your local Blockbusters and you're putting that on, you know, you're breaking a million children's hearts.
No doubt about it, man.
What if they turned it off at that point and said, I have to go to bed now? They never saw what happened.
Right. Yeah, I've always talked about back when Free Willy came out, it was such a big movie. It was like, it's one of those, if you were babysitting a kid and they were watching Free Willy and they fell asleep, and then you switched the tape out and put Orca the Killer Whale in. Oh no, look what Willie's doing.
Why is he doing that?
Get on Derek's leg.
They wouldn't know, would they?
Right.
And the same with, you know, Harry and Henderson's really. Yes. Really can cut you deep, you know. And a lot of these movies that we talk about that have heart, that are lighthearted and fun, there's even John Candy movies, you know, that will make you, you know, Planes, Trains and Automobiles. That last, you know, when he realizes his wife is dead, you know, that if that doesn't get tears in your eyes, so yeah, that's the thing with these movies, they grab you by the heart. They give you a great time, but that's why you're more open to these more emotional moments within them as well.
It's the roller coaster ride, man. You're going to have fun. You're going to be scared. You're going to be thrilled. You're going to be sad. It's going to play with all your emotions. And then at the end go, and they all lived happily ever after. The
with an El DeBarge song playing.
That's right. That's all you need, man. That's all you need.
The one that I couldn't sit through, without crying, was Batteries Not Included. Man, that was just a really sad film, and still is a really sad film.
Yeah.
You know,
and I think that maybe that's why they stay with us, because, you know, yes, the effects are so new for the time, but you get a unique story. But these things that happen in them stay with you, man. I mean, E.T. is still in my top 10 favorite movies of all time, and it's because it broke me. It was the first movie that made me feel something besides excitement or scared.
Yeah.
It really made me go, that's terrible. I care for this person. And well, it's not even a person. It was, you know, E.T. himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact of the other beauty of this, what makes this movie different is you don't have any children in this movie, you know.
That's a good show, actually. Yeah, because, you know, Harry, all these other movies we've talked about, they usually got some kids in it, usually the stars, you know. But this is Gutenberg, Fisher Stevens, Ali Sheedy, and a robot.
Yeah, but the robot is the kid.
Yeah, I suppose actually, yeah, you're
so
right.
There's your, you know, so the, that similar line that's running through all those that tie them all together. And again, I'm going to say it because you were just talking about it. But again, that's the magic of Ted Lasso. Because it does the same thing. It's going to make you laugh. It's going to make you cry. It's going to make you feel for these characters. And it's not just one character. You end up feeling for all of them. There's a point in this movie where you feel sorry for Gutenberg because Johnny's been killed, or number five's been killed. And he's trying to react and hold it together to make sure that Stephanie's okay, but he's traumatized by it too.
Yeah, and even the boss, when they blow him up, even his boss is like, that's not what we wanted to happen.
Right,
you know, the only person who's happy, of course, is G.W. Bailey.
Sure. Yeah, you know, of course, he comes down and he's, you know, well, we got him. We finally did what we wanted to do, and I'm just doing my job, sir. And so maybe from now on you can do your job somewhere else. And I was like, oh, all right.
And that's when he goes and works in the department store. And Kim Cattrall's going to provide, you know, lots of entertainment. So.
Hey, you know what? I'd take that job.
Ooh, me too. Me too. You know, we've talked about it. You know, my feelings on Kim Cattrall.
Hey,
a movie set in a small bubble where just a funny, weird story about an Egyptian woman who comes back in the form of a mannequin. That's the 80s for you. Weird science, you know, all these...
Yep.
They wouldn't make sense now.
Yep. You know. They would send in the script with some cocaine in the package and on top of it. They'd start it and go, all right, let's do it.
You must do this cocaine before reading this script. Okay, sure thing.
Yeah, man, we really haven't seen another time like it since. No. I mean, you have Independence doing some pretty interesting stuff. But as far as mainstream, we've just kind of gotten away from... the magic of it all, you know?
And the special thing about all the movies we've talked about for the most part of them is that they aren't fantasy set. They're not like Willow or Crow.
Yeah.
I mean, we mentioned one or two of these, but even like The Last Starfighter, that's about a guy on Earth who then gets to, you know, so these are all people we can relate to that then are having interactions with robots or aliens or supernatural beings or whatever it might be. You know, and that's why we relate to them, I guess, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Can you think of anything else you want to add to this?
A sequel is, it used to make me cry again as a kid when he gets chopped up at the end. But in hindsight, and I did rewatch it recently, it's nowhere near as good. It was a bit of a cash grab, really.
Sure.
But it's okay. It's got the Les Locos guys in it, which I like. But but no, other than that, I'm just glad that, and I just hope that they never really remake this. I just think it was one of those things. It's just, it's of its time, and yeah, there's a lot wrong with it, as we discussed. But there's a hell of a lot right with it, and
would you say
it's have a special place in my heart?
Lightning in a bottle.
I'd say it was lightning in a robot.
Lightning in a robot. Perfect. All right, we can give this a goofy rating, I guess. I always do 1 through 5. Mm. And, you know, I'm going to say 4.5.
I was going to say exactly the same. Exactly
the same. Of course. Again, we share the same brain.
I would love to give it a number 5 is alive out of 5. But, it's, you know, I'm in my late 40s now.
You know what?
Now,
it does need to be a 5 because 5 is alive. That's a good point.
Let's round it up.
Let's say it's 5. We'll round it up to 5. Yeah. Yeah,
there's a couple of flaws, but it's a 5 for us.
Is it something I'm going to watch continuously like I did Phantom of the Paradise? Probably not, but it's still very good. Very, very good. And again, it's great to go back and revisit these and you go, you know, these have staying power. There are still elements here that are really, really impressive. And you see why it was so big at the time. Mm. It still works.
This is one of about 20 movies of similar ilk that were on rotation all the time in my household as a child. So I do go back to those movies every few years. You know, I'll watch this one, I'll watch that one here and there. And they've all got special places in my heart because I was at a point where... So yeah, this is definitely a 5 for me then in that case, you know.
Well, this is like E.T. was for me. This is your E.T. I mean, specifically because it's of the time of your being at that age when... these things really start making an impression on you. And you don't forget those. They are the fabric of who we are. So you can't diss them, right? They are a part of you.
And somebody out there somewhere, for somebody out there, Mac and me is their E.T.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know? Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with it.
No.
Nothing wrong. So,
I mean, that was the purpose of it, right?
So. Other than the McDonald's tie-ins and... a few other bits and bobs, but maybe that's another show for another time, maybe. I don't
The only thing Mac and Me was missing was a Canon logo at the beginning.
Why? Wowie. There would have been a few ninjas in it, I expect, at that point.
That's what I'm saying. Maybe that's all it needed.
Okay.
I just watched a thing about ninja movies, and they went for a long time on Ninja 3. They're like, you know, Canon had it going on with, you know, Enter the Ninja, then you had Ninja 2, then you got Ninja 3, and it's amazing. That's the one they spent the most time on.
Wow. Canon ninjas.
All right. So, man, what you got going on? Give me some background of what's happening in Dan Bones podcasting.
So the podcast on Haunted Hill is my show that I do with Gav, and our next is my birthday episode. So when it's a birthday episode, the host whose birthday is gets to pick their movies. You're going to love this. Funny enough, talking of canon, I picked two Dolph Lundgren movies, one of which is, of course, Masters of the Universe.
Oh, yeah.
It falls under the horror umbrella. I'm trying to convince Gav. and the other one is the classic Dark Angel, which I believe in the US is called We Come in Peace.
I Come in Peace.
Which I absolutely love that movie. And it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I do remember lots of CDs being used as weapons.
Yeah.
Look out for my compact disc. So that's our next episode.
Very cool.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to recording that. So that's what we've got coming up. That's the podcast on Haunted Hill, if anyone wants to check it out.
And if you're not listening to that show, then you just need to quit listening to podcasts altogether, because it's just one of the best.
Well, it's an honor to be on your show, as always, because I absolutely love your show. And every time it comes out, which is almost every day, I'm there for it. Doing what you're doing. As I always message you, I do love it. And I'm happy to try and get on it whenever I can, you know, when the twins allow it and life and work and everything else falls.
I hear you. that's the Helming challenge. I mean, it's just like, hey, Danny, what you got going on? Well, I'm replacing the floor in my kitchen. Okay, we'll try another day. So he's living life, and he's got a double-handed grip on life right now. So, doesn't change anything. We're still the best of friends. We're going to see each other next month. We're going to Texas Frightmare.
Nice.
And get to spend the weekend together. So that'll be fun. Maybe we can get together and come up with an episode while we're there or something. Who knows? But nice. But yeah, man, it's always great having you around. I mean, I bounce ideas off you all the time. You're not just a guy that I want to have on the show. You're a friend that I reach out to and say, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And I
consider you a good
that.
Friend too, man.
Yeah, I appreciate that a lot. And always a blast. We always, like I said, we kind of share the same brain on a lot of stuff. So that's always fun.
It's quite scary sometimes, isn't it?
Absolutely. But that's okay.
That is okay.
Lets me know that I'm not alone. All right, folks, I believe that's going to be it for this one. If you have any ideas or anything like that, or shows or any comments of what Dad and I just talked about, feel free to let us know. And if you got some ideas for shows in the future that you kind of want me to cover, any movies, send them to me and I'll do what I want to anyways. So, but that's it for this one. So Dan, thanks for hanging out with me, man.
And we'll check you later.
Check you later.